This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
On Tuesday, April 23rd at 6 p.m., the DSR Network and the New Republic will be co-hosting an evening featuring a conversation with Secretary of Transportation Pete Buttigieg. The event will take place at the National Press Club. If you are a member and live or will be in the D.C. area and would like to attend, please email Riley Fessler at rmfessler@trgmedia.com. That's rmfessler@trgmedia.com. We have a few seats still available and would love to see you there.
This is Above Average Intelligence, a production of the DSR Network. Each week, hosts Mark Polymeropoulos and David Rothkopf are joined by leading experts from the intelligence community for expert analysis on the biggest security challenges around the world.
Welcome to the podcast. I'm Mark Polymeropoulos, and this is DSR's Above Average Intelligence Show. Today, I am very happy to welcome as my guest, Kylie Atwood, national security correspondent for CNN, based in Washington, D.C. Prior to joining CNN, she was the CBS News State Department reporter. Kylie has reported from dozens of countries around the world, including Russia, Afghanistan, China, Mexico. Kylie graduated from Middlebury College with a major in international studies, and I'm happy to say she's from Boston, so she's a Red Sox fan. Kylie, welcome.
Thank you for having me. This will be a lot of fun.
Absolutely. So I just kind of, what we do, this is super casual. So you'll see for the many thousands of listeners here, actually probably a smaller audience than the millions who see you on CNN. But just to,
Pretty popular, Mark.
No. So but you and I first met actually when you were covering Havana Syndrome, something that of course affected me. And you and the crew actually came to my house. And I will say that that interview that we did is probably the best one that I ever really experienced, because you were, you know, so thorough in your reporting, you were compassionate. But then I saw that as you kind of followed the story, you really dug into sources, and press sources. So I was super, super impressed. So I thank you for that. People have seen that interview we did so many times, super emotional on my part, but that was very meaningful.
No, I mean, it was an honor to do it. And it was also nice to be at your home and meet your wife and come to your basement and just see your home and learn about you beyond Havana Syndrome.
That's true. And you saw the very silly, everyone has this in the national security world, the I love me wall in my basement, all the kind of, photos of me with kings and queens and princes all over the Middle East. Very silly.
Honestly, you've said that there's similarities between journalism and being a national security expert like yourself. And I see that with journalists too. There's like the look at me wall in every journalist's office. And I'm like, am I going to build that? I don't know. I hope not.
You are definitely going to build that. You for sure are. And then one other quick point before we get started. I don't know if I think maybe a year or two ago, I passed you one of Don Winslow's crime novels about kind of the mafia wars in Rhode Island. And a new one is out. The last part of the series is out. And so
No way.
I just grabbed it. I got to read it. But when I'm done, I'll give it to you.
Please do.
Right. So look, what we're going to do today is we'll talk about some current topics first. There's so much in the news, and I've been wanting to get you on the show for a while because, as you cover the State Department, you are front and center in really two of the seminal events that are happening for U.S. national security. One is kind of the war in Gaza, and the other is Ukraine. But let's start off with Gaza, and what we do in all of this is, we don't get really political in this, but I just want to see your view from especially the State Department. And, the storylines are almost too numerous to get into. And we've talked about this on the pod a lot. But given your role covering State Department, let me kind of say or make a statement. I want to hear your reaction. In my nearly 30 years covering national security, working in national security, I have yet to see such a difficult foreign policy problem for administration. We can sit here and nitpick and criticize the Biden administration for a lot of things, but I got to tell you, it's hard. I mean, between, you know, stopping a regional war, obviously the humanitarian issue, you know, 1,200 Israelis dead, 50 Americans killed, 5 U.S. hostages, pending, you know, regional conflagration with Iran, you know, holy cow. So what's your thoughts on that? Have you seen something of this nature in your career covering national security?
No, I haven't. And I completely agree with you in terms of just how complicated this one is, particularly coming off of covering the beginning of the Ukraine war, which was very cut and dry. You know, there's a good actor and there's a bad actor when it comes to the Ukraine war, Russia being the bad actor, Ukraine being, you know, the good actor trying to defend itself and its territory and its people and all of that. With this conflict, it's convoluted. There are individual actors who are complicated. And, you know, this is also a foreign policy topic that has so much history attached to it. And I think that that makes it even more challenging for the experts who are drafting up this policy, because they want to take history into account here. They have to take history into account. It's their job. But at the same time, you also have to respond to what you're seeing happening before your eyes. And those two things don't always make it easy to make a coherent policy. The other thing that I've just, you know, reflected on in the last few months is I've been covering the State Department since January of 2016. My first press conference at the State Department was then Secretary of State John Kerry's last press conference. And then obviously we had Rex Tillerson come in, and I've been covering it ever since. I have never had to actually dig in and cover the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in that entire time covering the State Department, which is remarkable given that it is such an ever-present, you know, foreign policy challenge, but it had really been put on the back burner. And so, you know, like even coming back, I just had a child, even coming back from maternity leave, I'm not going to like my Russia sources or my China sources, you know, people who I've talked to constantly. You're going to, you know, folks working on the Middle East. And that's just a region that we haven't been covering all that much, because these flare-ups have just been that, flare-ups. It hasn't turned into this all-out conflict that we're seeing now. And I think that's just really interesting.
I think what you said about the history is really important. You know, I worked on the Middle East most of my career. And, you know, so October 7th, you know, you wake up in the morning. Actually, I had about 50 texts from MSNBC, you know, asking me to come on air. And when I finally got a hold of someone, they said, well, a 3,000 person or man Hamas terrorist army just invaded Israel. And, you know, and I looked, and, you know, my wife, Cynthia, and I looked at Cynthia and I said, you know, did we drink too much last night? You know what I mean? Are you kidding me?
What just right? happened? How is that possible?
How is that possible? So, But then you saw here's what I want your reaction on. Then you saw the bear hug, and for all the right reasons, this is the Biden kind of embrace of the Israelis. But for those of us who've been in the region for a long time, and this is not, I'm not condoning behavior or criticizing behavior, is that, you know, Israel does have a different view of civilian casualties. They always have. I've worked with them. I've worked in the region for so long. I've been on the ground in places like Lebanon and Syria. And so with that bear hug, you know, I remember my reaction is, ooh, you know, this is seemingly the right thing to do, but you know what? This might get messy later on. And then talking to a former head of Mossad's counterterrorism directorate, you know, he said, Zohar Palti, he said, you know, we're not going to be very nice. And so, you know, what is your reaction to the bear? Were you surprised when you saw that full embrace? And do you think the national security, you know, media understood the significance of that?
So I think two things. First of all, I wasn't surprised. Knowing what I know about Washington and the relationship with Israel and the QME that we talk about with Israel and President Biden's, you know, in terms of his foreign policy perspectives, I was not surprised to see it. And frankly, after that moment, how could they not have? I mean, they really didn't have an option. That was a horrific, just awful assault on those Israelis who, you know, we should note, they're the ones who are living on the border and trying to, you know, make it work in this incredibly hard dynamic. But they're, you know, they're the kindest people out there, and they've just been assaulted, or, you know, young people who are at this concert. I mean, I don't think that there was really an option there. So I wasn't surprised. But I also simultaneously don't think that all of us all realized how complicated it was likely to get, because as I pointed out, we haven't been covering this conflict, in the nitty gritty, in a detailed sense over the last, you know, 10 years, really. There have been flare ups and there's, you know, a statement here or a statement there, but then we kind of move on. And so I don't think that we were really steeped in the characters on both sides and how complicated it was going to get. And so I think, you know, from a reporter's perspective, that was the case. But I also think that was probably the case, from the official's perspective who were working on this. I have to say, I was also on maternity leave. So I was watching this, you know, with a 2-week-old baby in my arms, which was a very strange dynamic. You know, it was the first time that there was like a major story that I wasn't a part of. But it was, you know, I couldn't stop watching the television.
You know, I think you also have a unique perspective from being at the department. Well, now you're back, of course, after maternity leave, and congratulations. As you know, we were thrilled for you and your family, but you know, so you're at the State Department. It's a unique organization. You know, I kind of play acted at the State Department for a while. I actually had at one point a plaque that I had passed the Foreign Service exam, and was a Foreign Services officer. Of course, that's not true.
Yeah, but, I was going to say. Huh.
But it's a unique entity. I have tons of friends there. But we have seen in the news there's been some dissension at State, more so than other U.S. government national security entities, about, you know, particularly Israeli conduct in Gaza and the civilian casualties. What is it like there, you know, covering the department, you know, in terms of, do you hear about that dissension? Is that something openly talked about? And how has the Secretary of State and kind of the senior staff on the top levels, how have they handled that?
Yeah, so you're right. There's been some, and there have been, you know, there were a handful of State Department folks who resigned shortly after October 7th. We've seen we saw one more in the recent history. And I talk to people who are just put really downtrodden about this. I think that's the way to put it. More so that they're angry, more so than being angry, excuse me. They're just like sad and upset. And, you know, it's not like they think that they have the right policy solution for this administration, because there's no easy fix to this one. And yes, are there people in the department who think that there could be a bit of a tougher minded approach to the Israelis to make them, you know, hold back in terms of how aggressive their assault is in Gaza right now? Of course there are. But I don't think it's to the degree that they don't feel their voices are heard in the interagency, because they are actually trying to work through those issues. And I think, you know, one example of them trying to work through those issues is, according to, you know, some reports out there, it's ProPublica has actually reported on it, but there are some factions of the Israeli military and the Israeli police that committed human rights abuses pre-October 7th. The State Department is going through a process right now of reviewing those apparent episodes. And apparently this week, we're likely to hear some sort of, you know, a decision from them in terms of if they actually think these are human rights abuses, what they're going to do about it, if they roll out sanctions, that sort of thing. Unfortunately, it takes a long time for these processes to play out, right? And I was talking to someone who was, you know, involved in this the other day, and, you know, they were saying it took a while for the, you know, for the bureaus to actually take up this case. And They were wary about it coming at this moment in time and how complicated it could get, but they did eventually take it up, right? So I think what that shows me is that there is a willingness at the highest levels to do the right thing, but it doesn't mean that people at the department aren't just upset about a region that they care a lot about, because a lot of them have spent time there, have served there, you no Palestinians, no Israelis. And it's a tough moment for them on a human level because of that.
So, yeah, and I sympathize with them in some sense. You know, it's hard, even as a commentator on this. You know, I'm actually, right after this, I'm going to UVA to give a lecture to students tonight. And this has all the potential to be a disaster for me. Because, you know, for a couple of reasons. One is, you know, there's so many nuances. You know, I've worked with all sides in this. I've worked with the Israelis. I've served in Jordan and Egypt. I've, you know, been to Palestinian intelligence headquarters in Ramallah, and I can actually make arguments on all sides. Not nothing to do with Hamas. Hamas is a terrorist organization, and you know, and certainly has to be, destroyed, if not degraded, if not, destroyed, depending on, you know, what your definition is. But you can't help but kind of scratch your head and really, you know, wonder about the civilian casualties. I mean, this is atrocious. So so I think that a lot of U.S. national security officials have those same feelings. One of my questions, though, to you, and we'll talk about it a little bit later too, but as a journalist, you know, you're not, I mean, you know, I think that, you know, the networks actually have done a pretty good job on this because it's so nuanced, but you're not immune to human emotion. I mean, you know, you can't sit there and you don't, and generally reporters are pretty responsible. No one's really cheerleading for one side or the other, but you know, so you can be sympathetic. You know, I went to the Israeli embassy and I saw that 47-minute video of the atrocities. But at the same time, if you're a reporter and you have some access to Gaza, you see thousands of civilians killed. How do you kind of keep that emotion out of your reporting as someone like yourself, so respected, working for, you know, one of the best networks, in the world, and someone who's, you know, people are going to watch you, you know, every night. How do you do that? How do you keep the emotion out of it, if you can?
So I think I would say it's easier for me to keep the emotion out than it is for my colleagues who are in the field. And here's why. When you're not there and you're not seeing it with your own eyes, and you're reporting on it and it's really hard, but it's just different than seeing it with your own eyes, I think. And you can still be emotional. Like reporters are allowed to have emotions. Yeah. I mean, I think we've kind of gotten away from this like perception of a reporter as this sort of robotic entity who wears a collared shirt and, you know, presents like A, B, and C and signs off, right? But I do think that there's room for emotion. I also think that you have to weigh multiple instances at one time in order to have a perspective that is measured. And so, you know, if you're only reporting on one element of what has been, you know, this horrific back and forth over the last 8 months or what have you, you have to somehow involve the other things that have happened to provide context. And so I think that that's important to do. I will say though, Mark, having a child also makes you a little bit more emotional about these things than I think I had been before, because you naturally, as a person, you envision it being your own child, no matter, you know, what children you're talking about or what children you're seeing these malnourished photos of. And it makes it weigh a little bit more heavily on me than I would say it has in the past. It was a little easier to come home and, you know, be home and sort of sign off of work. And, you know, now it lingers. And I don't think that that's necessarily a bad thing. I think it just makes you take it all that much more seriously.
I think I agree with you wholeheartedly. It's just, this is not the first time I've heard from a national security reporter who said that, and other colleagues of yours, both you know, male and female, who've had have new families, have said the same thing. And I think that's good. And why, you know, why is that good? Because you actually can challenge officials on every side who kind of say something, and you're like, well, hold on a second. You know, one of the things that I think you're very good at, and others are as well, is you know, you of course you have to report the news, but if you hear officials say something that's so you know, out of bounds, you can politely push back against them. That's your job as a journalist. Let's flip to another, you know, rather extraordinary conflict, and that's Ukraine. And I you know me, of course I'm Greek, so I certainly tend to to be a bit hyperbolic. So what I say now, tell me if I'm right or wrong. Was the vote on Saturday night, you know, did that literally save U.S. standing in the world? How important was that? You know, as you travel, of course, with the secretary, and, you know, you are part of a forward-facing organization at the State Department, and as a CNN national security correspondent, the world watches us. So how important was this vote? I thought it was, you know, probably, I don't know, again, my heart, my Greek side of me is going to get too dramatic, but most important in several decades, century. I mean, this was a big deal. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think the irony in the vote over the weekend is that you had U.S. officials and you had members of Congress for, you know, weeks, if not months now, telling their foreign interlocutors, we're going to get this done, we're going to get this done, we're going to get this done. If they hadn't have gotten it done, America's reputation and reliability would have been in the gutter, and they had to. I mean, or else I think the world trusting the United States would have been at stake for a long time. And you know, look, our politics are particularly partisan and divisive and messy right now. The world sees that, they watch that, it has an impact on them. But if, you know, a few members of Congress were able to completely disrupt the Ukrainians from getting the support that the majority of the U.S. Congress and all branches of government wanted them to get, that would have been really, really dangerous. And so I fully agree with you that the vote this weekend was, incredibly critical for the standing of the U.S. globally right now.
It was interesting. I think CNN had some really good reporting on this as well, about how, you know, it was CIA Director Bill Burns and, you know, classified briefings to Speaker Johnson, as well as pressure from what's called the three mics. Was it Turner, McCall,
Rogers,
and Rogers of the various kind of national security committees in the House and the GOP side, really was instrumental. But, you know, the way I think about this too is, you know, if I was a case officer still, and, you know, perhaps I would be working with my colleagues, I will say this, you know, safely, in and around Ukraine, somewhere in the region, on the ground with Ukrainians. I mean, you know, I think, you know, and we heard statements that there was cheers in the Ukrainian front lines. I could honestly, you know, envision conversations between CIA case officers working with their Ukrainian counterparts now, and everyone breathing a huge sigh of relief. And I agree with you, just in terms of our standing in the world was at stake. When you go and travel, it's amazing to me. And you heard it from reporting too. I mean, you know, people around the world are actually following a vote on Saturday night on Capitol Hill. That's how important this was. I remember, you know, a couple of years ago, jumping in a taxi in Europe, and a cab driver kind of asking me about the intricacies of, you know, of U.S. Domestic politics, particularly on the Hill. So the world watches, and I think we, you know, we dodged a huge bullet. There's one side of me, of course, that says, you know, this was the right thing to do. So as my wife said to me today, like, you know, should we give like Speaker Johnson a cookie for doing the right thing? I mean, he had to do this. That said, pretty remarkable efforts.
He had to do it, but I mean, I would say he did it, right? We saw what happened with the last speaker who didn't get it done.
Right. Right.
And so beyond just the effect on the battlefield, it has ripple effects for so many other things, you know, not just America's standing kind of rhetorically, but the Secretary of State is going to China this week. I'm going with him. And top of the list is him pressing the Chinese not to continue supporting Russia's defense industrial base. I mean, imagine him trying to have delivered that message while the Chinese could sit there and say, well, I'm sorry, but, you know, you're asking us to do this. You can't even, you know, put up your end of the bargain when it comes to supporting the Ukrainians. So there's real practical impacts for diplomats around the world that is not just symbolic.
Agreed, 100%. I think back to my career, attending numerous, diplomatic receptions around the world. This was, after Saturday, it's a good time to do that. Kind of the U.S. is kind of seen in a bit of a different light, and I totally agree with you that our adversaries watch and learn
and use it.
And use it. So this sends a tremendous message. You also saw, of course, on social media, kind of the Russian, political and security elite having a total meltdown over the vote, which was kind of fun. At this point in the podcast is where we have to say goodbye to our guests who are not yet subscribers. If you want to listen to the rest of the pod and to all of our other shows in full, just go to the DSRnetwork.com and click on membership. It's only $7 a month, and it brings you a lot of great bonus content. So if you're not a subscriber, we hope you will be soon. And if you are one, stand by. We'll be right back with Kylie in a moment.
Thank you for listening to Above Average Intelligence, hosted every week by Mark Polymeropoulos and David Rothkopf. Above Average Intelligence is a production of the DSR Network and was produced by Riley Fessler.